like that before we get started. Okay, so to review from last time. Last time we started talking about the big O notation. And what I wanted to talk about now, the problem of the day has to do with big O. Okay, question. Could I focus a little bit? And the answer is I can't do anything. Maybe what we could do is ask people to... So the point is I don't think I can focus anything, and you probably don't even want me to try it if you see the way I can work this thing already. I'll try to remember to ask them to focus it a little bit more. Okay? But so sorry about that. Any other questions? Fair enough. So the question is problems of the day. It says find two functions, okay, f and g, that satisfy the following relationships. And if no f and g exist, write none. Now, the first thing to note is that some of these problems describe a little o, okay? And people could interpret this, if I saw this and I didn't know what I was new to this game, I might interpret that as a typo. It's not a typo, okay? Well, it's something I probably didn't explain right. So let's start just with the stuff that is clear and obvious, the stuff that has big omegas and big thetas, parts 3 and 4, okay? Part 3 said, the way I like to do the daily problems, most of the daily problems, I don't actually look at them until I get to class, so we can sort of cover how we might think about it. F and G, it says that F is of N, for number 3, is theta of G of N. Okay? And f of n is not in big O of g of n. Okay? Those are the first questions. And when I ask, is it possible to find functions like that, I would be trying to draw the functions and thinking about it. So I would be drawing a function here saying that if the first part is true, here is a function f of n, right? What does f of n equal to theta of g of n mean? It means that there is some c1 times g of n that's above it and some c2 g of n that is below it, right? That's exactly what theta of g of n means, right? And now they're telling me that f of n is not big O of g of n. And I say, wait a second, for it to be omega, it's got to have this thing, right? This shows that f of n is less than a constant times g of n. Big O says that there is a constant times g of n, such that that's bigger than f of n. This says that this thing says that there is one. This thing says it's not true. That says that there's a contradiction. Does everybody agree? So write none as my answer there. Any questions? Let's go to different colors because I like different colors. Okay? What about the second example? The second example says, again, I always draw a picture because I have a hard time thinking about this stuff. F of n, here's f of n. Omega is a lower bound, right? That means what? That there is some constant c1 times g of n, such that f of n is bigger than that. Okay? Does everybody agree that's what the omega is? And it says we also want it to be the case that f of n is not big O of g of n. Okay? That means that I want f of n to be big. That this can be done if f of n is big and g of n is small. Does everybody agree with that? So what would be an example of this, where there is a big difference between f of n and g of n? If f of n, let's say I said f of n equals n squared, what would be a value of g of n? N. There is a big gap, a dominance gap, between n squared and n, right? They are different from the big O. They're not theta of each of other. Yes. Can I get rid of my, oh no, first of all, under no conditions can I get rid of my picture. That happens to be true. I can't get rid of my pictures, but I can try to redraw it in a different place. That's really what you're really saying, right? You still want to see my picture, but you want me to try to figure out how to erase this, right? And let's see if I can do this here. At various points in time, I can do this. Ah, that's what you really want to say, right? So let's go. Now you want to see the thing in green, probably, right? Okay? So here we have the case that we know that f of n is bigger than g of n, bigger than or equal to, right? That's really what this means. F of n is bigger than or equal to g of n. That's the way I interpret that. Okay? So when is this, and you're saying this would say that f of n is smaller than or equal to g of n, right? We want to now know when is it the case that f of n is strictly bigger than g of n, right? That's really what this question number 4 is saying. So if I make this n squared, and this n, f of n is going to be strictly bigger than g of n, okay? And so f of n is not in n, n squared is not in n, O of n, but n squared is lower bounded by g of n. Any questions about that? Okay? Fair enough. Now, what does the little o mean? Okay? I didn't describe it before, okay? Although actually, I think we will see it in a few slides, okay? Little o of n is something we use to describe something that is strictly beaten, okay? So what do I mean? When I say that f of n is little o of g of n, it means that if it was big O means that it's less than or equal to. Is that right? Isn't that one way to think of what big O means? Big O I think of as meaning something like less than or equal to. Little o means much less than, okay? It means that there is, that this thing is small potatoes relative to this, okay? It means that there is a difference. It's not, there's not a theta relation. I think what it means is exactly this. If we, or something like this, is that if we have a function with the property, and again, let's just take a look at this thing, where here is g of n, and here is f of n, okay? Here f of n is smaller than g of n, right? If the gap is such that that there is not a theta relationship between it, this is asymptotically smaller than that, right? Big O says smaller than or equal to, right? Little o means smaller than. Okay? So if we wanted to say a big O relationship, something that was here n squared and here n is a little o, you know, n, f of n is little o of n squared. It is not only less than or equal to g of n, but it is clearly much smaller. And that's what we mean by little o. Any questions? Okay? Yes. You're saying there should, by all rights, be something that is bigger than, but not bigger than n. And the short answer is, somebody probably defines such a thing. I don't find it useful enough to talk about, that I don't even remember what such a symbol is. In principle, there is such a relationship, right? Okay? But in principle, I don't know of a symbol that represents that. Okay? Any questions? Okay? And we'll see why little o is actually useful in a few minutes, okay? Any questions? So let's just think what this means, okay? Is it possible now, let's look at the first one, that f of n is little o of g of n. What does that mean? That means that f of n is much smaller than g of n. And f of n is not theta of g sub n. Is that possible? Certainly. In fact, this is a perfect example of it, isn't it? Okay. Any questions about that? F sub n is growing strictly slower than g of n. And certainly this would mean that they're growing the same. Okay? So saying they're not growing the same, and this is growing slower than that. Bingo. Any questions about that? And what about the next one with the little o? Is it possible that f of n is or theta of g of n? And f of n is little o of g of n. Is that possible? No. This is saying that they are the same thing. F of n and g of n are hanging around in the same neighborhood, right? They're both very similar functions. And this is saying that f of n is peanuts compared to this one, right? This one is beating, this one is much faster than this. These two are the same. Can that be possible? The answer is no. So this is a none. This, I said, was a none. And these two both pointed at that. Any questions about that? About how these things work? Okay? You have to solve any big O kind of problem, you have to go back to the definition. Okay? And once you go back to the definition of what these things mean, they make logical sense. If you wildly guess at them, you will get them right, provided you guess correctly. Otherwise, go back to the definition. Any questions? Okay, good. Let me now see if I can switch it. Okay? Bink. Ah, bink. Uh-oh, trouble. Okay, good. Okay, so last class we were talking about, we started talking about what was the meaning or impact of this big O business. And we talked about this kind of table here. Oops, let me go back. With this table here, where I showed you that as the complexity of the function goes up, the size of the amount of time it takes, if we think of a function, this being a function, discovering how many steps an algorithm takes, as the function gets more and more complicated, there is a sharp bound for every function of how big a problem it is where it can be feasible, right? That we saw that for an n factorial function, it was somewhere between 10 and 20. And for a 2 to the n function, it was somewhere between 30 or 40-ish. And when we were looking at a quadratic function, it was somewhere between 10 and 100,000. Okay? Maybe, somewhere in that ballpark. And for something n log n, well, we hadn't quite reached it. Maybe we were reaching it near a billion or 100 million. But for a linear time thing, we could pretty much work on something as big as a billion without the number of steps getting prohibitively large. A billion steps on a fast computer is not that many steps, okay? It's not that many seconds. And the reason why we're going to care about the big O, when we look at an algorithm, I'm more interested in breaking down which of these classes does an algorithm go in, and trying to find an algorithm in the lowest class of function possible, then I am worried about if I can make the algorithm run twice as fast or something like that. An algorithm that runs twice as fast or half as slow, depending upon how you think of it, is good, but that's nothing like something that runs one-nth as fast, because that's where, when it depends, that governs the size of the input you can hope to handle, okay? And that's where the big wins are. Any questions? That's sort of the Greek principle that we're going to be trying to do here. Okay, let me try this now. Bing, and bing, bing. Okay, so as we said, these dominance, these functional categories that we say govern the complexity of what is reasonable and what is not reasonable. Exponential algorithms become unreasonable for almost anything once you get past a trivial size. Quadratic algorithms are potentially useful, but you have to watch how big a thing you run it on. And something faster than quadratic is probably good enough for whatever you're going to be needing to do when you talk about a big algorithm problem. Okay? Any questions about that? So that's why we're going to care about these categories. Okay? Any questions? So what do these categories mean exactly? This is where we're going to talk a little bit more about the big O. And in particular, talk about this idea of a little O. Okay? We say that one function, f of n, dominates g of n if the limit of g of n over f of n goes to zero as n goes to gets infinitely large. You guys all saw limits when you took calculus. Most of you have probably forgotten them. What does that mean? We're interested in what is the function, a value of this, the limit is. If we take the ratio of functions, we're interested in what is that limit going to as n gets larger and larger, okay? If the limit of g of n over f of n is zero, what does that mean about the relative values of f of n? Which is bigger, f of n or g of n?
Okay, hold on.
Okay, it means that that f of n has to be the bigger one. Does everybody agree with that? So, is it? But it has to be bigger in a big way. Suppose we have g of n is n squared. Let's say g of n was n, and f of n was n squared. What is the ratio of n over n squared? That it simplifies to 1 over n. As n gets bigger and bigger, what happens to 1 over n? Smaller and smaller and smaller. Does everybody agree that that's going to approach 0? That's because f of n dominates g of n. Okay? Equivalently, this is the same notion as the little o. Remember, we just talked about the little o, right? If strictly g of n grows strictly slower than f of n, we say g of n is little o of f of n, okay? And that's where the little o of n came up from in the the little o in the previous problem came by. Any questions about that? So what's interesting about this is somehow this dominance relation partitions the space of all possible functions into classes, where one class dominates another class, dominates another class, dominates another class. Okay? Any questions about that? So what does this mean? Suppose I have a function that is order big O, that is n to the A. Okay? And another function that is n to the B. These are polynomials, where A is bigger than B. Let's say if A is bigger than B, let's say we have n to the 3.7 versus n to the 3.2. Is there a, does n to the 3.7, does that dominate n to the 3.2? Or are they very similar functions? Well, how would we tell? We would take the limit of it. What is the limit of, okay, n to the 3.2 divided by n to the 3.7? Is there a way of simplifying n to the 3.2 over n to the 3.7? That would be equal to really what? 1 over n to the what? 0.5, right? Does everybody see that? As n gets larger, is n to the 0.5 getting larger? What is another way to talk about n to the 0.5? What is that? Square root of n, is that right? As n gets bigger and bigger, is the square root of n getting bigger and bigger? You bet you. Who's going to win a fight between square root n and 1? Square root n is growing faster, right? So doesn't that ratio go to, that ratio is going to be going to 0, correct? Isn't that true? So that tells us that n to the 3.2 is beaten by n to the 3.7, right? It's dominated by it. And in fact, for any two polynomials, the one with the bigger exponent wins. Who dominates? If we have n to the 2 versus n to the 1.9999999. Who wins? N to the 2, n squared, dominates anything that is lower than it, right? This takes a little getting used to it. This dominates this. Who dominates between n squared and a million n squared? Who dominates? Nobody dominates. No, not nobody really dominates. Nobody dominates. Okay? They're the same thing. What is the ratio here? What is the limit of n squared over a million n squared? Well, it's not the ratio is not 1. What's the ratio of n squared over a million n squared? 1 over a million. The important thing is that limit didn't go to 0, right? Not that it was 1. It's that it stayed something that was not 0, right? So this function beats up on that function. This function and this function, they're the same to us. Okay? Any questions about that? Any questions about why that might be? Or people believe that? So the ranking of functions by exponent in a polynomial is important to us. Any questions? Now what about a separate case? What about the case that we have a function here of the form n squared? How does it compare to n squared plus 100 n to the 1.99? Which one of these two is bigger? You get that one there. Which one of these two is bigger than the other one? Are they the same? Well, how would we tell if they're the same? We go back to the definition. We have to do the limit, right? What is the limit as n squared over n squared plus 100 n to the 1.99? What's going to be like as n gets bigger and bigger? Okay? And again, you have to actually do the limit. Okay? And in some sense, when you took limits in high school, this might have been obvious. Okay? But it seems clear to me this is not going to go to 0. What is this going to sort of go to? The limit here is going to go to 1. Why is that? Okay? As n gets bigger and bigger, this is eventually going to get bigger than that. Does everybody agree with that? And as it keeps getting bigger and bigger than that, you've got a big thing over a big thing plus a small thing, right? If we consider this a race as n gets larger and larger, the bigger thing is going to leave this thing, make the slower thing go further and further behind, right? The contribution as n gets larger of this relative to this is less. So the upshot is that these two, neither one of them dominates. Okay? And that's going to have an important property to it. How many people believe that? How many people believe that when we add a lower order polynomial, it doesn't make it any more powerful? Okay? How many people don't believe that or don't accept that? Okay? It wasn't completely convincing. But I think that you should believe it. And once you believe it, though, it makes your life much easier. Why is that? Suppose I asked you, remember we had on our original slide, we had something like 3n squared. Yes, the other class, I was dealing with you about something like this, right? A function that looked like 3n squared minus 100n plus 6, right? Knowing that the higher exponent dominates the lower exponent, did I need to think about this 100n at all when I was thinking about the big onus of this entire term, right? Does everybody agree that since n squared dominates n, the big onus of 3n squared minus 100n plus 6, I don't have to worry about that, right? Because this is the lower order thing added to a bigger order thing. Does everybody believe that? And what about this thing? This is 6. What is this 6 equal to? You could view this as just a constant, or you could view it as 6 times n to the 0. Does everybody agree with that? What's n to the 0? 1, right? So does 3n squared beat up 6n0? Certainly, this thing goes away, right? So this thing is really just 3n squared, if we think about it in a big O sense, right? And what else can we do to simplify it? Does that 3 mean anything to us? Just another constant to worry about, right? So the neat thing is, when we think about these functions in a big O sense, we can whittle away a lot of the detail. And all we're caring about is the driving term of the function. That's the important thing. Any questions about that? Okay. That is why we like this stuff, is we're eliminating all these distractions of smaller terms and constants and stuff like that. And only how does the thing increase in complexity? Any questions? Okay, good. Let's try if we can do this thing. Let's say bunk. 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 Okay. So in particular, when you analyze algorithms in this class, we are going to be interested in basically these functions. Okay? It's going to be important to know where these functions sit in a hierarchy. That there is a big difference between n factorial and 2 to the n. Okay? This is much, much bigger than this. 2 to the n is much, much bigger than n cubed. N cubed is much, much bigger than n squared. N squared is much bigger than n times log n. What is n times log n? Well, log n is a function. You know about logarithms. People, you've certainly heard about them, and you're going to hear a lot more about them soon. Okay? N times log n is a function. That is the function n times the function log n. What is the function n? It is the function n squared. It is the function n times n. Does everybody agree with that? N beats up on log n. N dominates log n. So n times n dominates n times log n. Does everybody agree with that? Should believe that, or if you don't believe it, you should accept it. Okay? The way you would prove such things, of course, is by taking the limits. Okay? Any questions? N times log n grows much faster than n. Because n gets to log n gets to infinity if you give it a large enough value of n, right? So n times log n, what's the ratio for n times log n? N over n times log n, that's going to be 1 over log n, right? Log n gets to infinity, so the limit is going to be 0. N times log n dominates n. N dominates log n. And log n dominates 1, okay? These are the main classes of complexity functions we will deal with in here. And it's important to know the pecking order of these things. Any questions about that? Yes? I think you would take things like derivative. I think it was like L'Hopital. I mean, I'm a lot further from calculus than you are, but I seem to remember something called L'Hopital's rule. Does that sound familiar to someone, right? You took derivatives of things. So in principle, that's how you would do these kind of things. Doing algebraic things on logs is a little bit different than doing it with polynomials, okay? But that's in principle how you would do these kind of limits, okay? Any questions about that? So you should believe and understand what the pecking order is. These are the bread and butter functions we will work with this semester. Any questions about that? Okay? And if you go on to further in algorithm analysis, you will find that there's lots of other functions people worry about. Okay? I mean, some other ones that we look at here, I'm not going to really go through these, but recognize if you read more in logarithm in algorithms, you'll see algorithms with all sorts of Baroque complexity functions. These make sense once you're a good, a sophisticated algorithm designer. But it might not be bad to figure out where they lay. The functions that you don't see may be here. Why is square root n less than log n? Less than n. Can anybody figure out why square root n has to be less, grow slower than log n? That may look weird to you. Unless, what is another name for square root n?
Okay, sorry about this.
This is n to the 1/2, right? Is n to the 1/2 grow slower than n to the 1? Certainly it should, right? So that makes sense why it's sitting there. It turns out that any product of logarithms grows much slower than any polynomial, okay? So n to the 0.0000001 beats up on log n, or log n squared, or log n cubed, or log n to the 1/100th, okay? Log n's grow very, very slowly, okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so I don't want to dwell on this, but if you're interested, you can look at these. I guess some of these functions are actually interesting. If I write log squared n, that means log n times log n. If I write log n times log n, clearly that grows faster than log n. Does everybody agree with that? Because the ratio of log n over log n times log n is 1 over log n. Everybody see that? Be clear here. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. Let's try this. Boop. And boop. Okay. So those are the complexity functions that we're dealing with. Any questions about that? The final piece of the puzzle when it comes to analyzing algorithms is, in my mind, how to relate an algorithm to a complexity function, okay? So when I'll be talking in here, I'll be saying, oh, selection sort, order n squared. Now, where does that come from? We know that somehow we're talking about worst case running times, okay? The final, let's say, bit of machinery that may not be obvious when you're analyzing an algorithm is this notion, how do I go from a algorithm to a complexity function and describing the running time of that algorithm. And usually these things are very easy, or at least grossly easy, if I am given a written down description of the algorithm, okay? So when you hear me talking in class and I'll be mumbling something, okay, binary search, it's log n, okay? Implicitly, what am I thinking? In my head, I am visualizing binary search, okay? In my head is written down a description of the binary search algorithm. And by looking at that algorithm, okay, I am able to analyze it and look and think, what are the worst case number of most steps it'll take in the worst case? When you're good at it, okay, you can do this by thinking about the algorithm in your head. When you're just beginning, it's important to be able to take a look at a program and see what its running time might be. So actually, let's go back here. Here is an algorithm. This is an algorithm for selection sort. Does anybody know what the selection sort algorithm is? What's a selection sort algorithm? So the idea here is I give you a bunch of numbers to sort. What are they? 3, 17, 1, 14, 36, okay? Selection sort goes through all of the elements. Says I want to find which is first. I find which is the minimum one. This is smaller. 1 is the smallest so far. 1 is the smallest. I then swap 1. The first element in the array with the smallest one, right? And I now say, this part of the array is sorted. I now go through this and I say for the remaining part of the array, which is the smallest element? It is this one, okay? I swap that one with the first one that is in place. Now this thing is sorted, and I have this remaining array. I go through and find what is the smallest one of these guys. It is this one. I swap that with the first position of the unsorted one. Ka-chunk. And move this forward. I now compare this part. Which is the smaller one of the two? 14. I swap that with the fourth element here. Stays where it is. I move on. Last element. It basically has to be in the right place, right? That's what selection sort is. Does everybody agree with that? I've described that in English. Everyone sort of understands it. Here's a program for it. Implicitly for every algorithm, you can think of an implementation of that algorithm. That is a program that does it. Here's a program in C. What is it doing? For I goes from 0 to n of I. The index of the minimum element is I, initially I. Then for every element from I to the end, test whether the jth element is less than the min. If so, min is now the index set to j, because min is going to be the index of the smallest unsorted element so far, right? Then I swap min, the minth element with the ith element, and then bop up I again. Does everybody see that? Any questions about how my code works? Okay. Now, how would we look at this thing and analyze its running time? What is its running time? Anybody have any ideas? Yeah. It is order n squared. Now, why is it order n squared? Okay. Two loops is one way to say it, okay? But that's not completely enough, okay? The important thing to see here is that this loop goes from 0 to n, right? And nested with it is another loop that goes, well, from I to n, huh? That's interesting. How many times can this go around? If I was n, this would go around how many times? Well, if I was n, what would this loop go around? If I said I equals n, it goes from n plus 1 to n, less than n. How many times will it go around? 1 or 0, if depending upon how you want to look at it, right? Right? Does everybody see that the number of times the loop goes around is the difference between the indices, right? The starting point to the ending point. Does everybody see that? So one way to think about it is to say, gee, I've got to count up all the different values. I could be 1, 2, 3, 4. The other way to think about it is a worst case big O. The reason why we think about worst case is because it's easy. What is the most number of times this loop can go around? Does everybody agree? N times? Because I is always at least 0, right? So every time this loop starts, it can go around at most n times. So let's pick the worst of those possibilities, which is n. It is contained within a loop that is going around at how many times? N times here. N times at most n is what? At most n squared. Does everybody agree with that? So we get an idea that this is going to be big O of n squared in the worst case. Any questions about it? What about the other things in this program? Here I'm doing this extra step, right? This min equals I. How much does that count? How many times is this step getting executed? Basically n times, right? This is n times, what is it? So the total time, it's going to be n times the cost of this plus the cost of this. Does everybody agree with that? Which is bigger, the time spent in this loop or the time spent executing the men? The time spent in this loop, right? Think about how much time this is. Let's try to clear this out and see if we can accept this. Okay? If we think about how many times this is going around, this is going around n times. This is costing us one step each time, right? This is costing us one step each time. This is costing us one step each time, right? But this here is in a loop that's going around n times. Does everybody see that? So I'm looking at this. This is n times n plus 1 plus 1, right? In a big O sense, can this 1 help me at all? We multiply it out. This is n squared plus 2n. What did I just argue about dominance, right? This stuff is small potatoes. It's not going to affect us, okay? So the things that are depending upon this are, there's a loop going around n times, each of which is doing a constant number of steps in each iteration. And this is nested within something that is going around n times. Okay? N times n is n squared. Any questions about how you would analyze this? Okay? Any questions? What if I had a program, an algorithm where I had a loop here, for I equals 1 to n. And when that's finished, I have a separate loop for j equals 1 to n. And this says do something, and this says do something. What is the complexity of this algorithm? This is something here that takes n steps, right? Then I'm doing something else that takes n steps. What is n plus n? You say 2n. I don't think like that. N plus n is n. Okay? Does everybody agree with that? I'm thinking big case, worst. I don't care about that. That level of constants times it. Okay? Any questions about that? What if in this loop, instead I had to go through, for I goes from 1 to less than square root n? Suppose the loop went from 1 to square root n. And that was nested within a loop that went from 1 to n. What would that be? What would be the time complexity of this thing? This would be square root n. It would be n times square root n. Which is what? O to the n to 3 halves. Does everybody see that? Okay. So the thing that's going to be the case, when I start talking about algorithms, I'm not going to be going through with this slowly. I'm often going to be designing an algorithm in my head saying, like the level we talked about selection sort originally. It's important for you to see that somehow from that description of what the algorithm is, ka-chunk, there is a program hanging out there that is implementing that. Okay? And what I am doing is analyzing that program. Okay? Any questions about that? The trick to getting these things right, though, is to make sure you've thought out all the things in the algorithm that take more than constant time. Sometimes you might be using a data structure. Let's say that to look up the smallest element, I instead used a data structure where each one of these queries took log n, instead of storing it in an array where I look up the jth element in constant time. Let's say I was using a data structure where, in fact, it took log n time to access that element. What would the time complexity of this be? Well, now it's getting kind of got a loop that's going around square root n time. Each step within here is going to be taking, how long is this line going to be taking? Log n, right? What would the complexity of that algorithm be? It would be order n to the times square root n times log n, which would be n to the 3 halves log n. Do people see that? The actual cost of counting these things is just taking for each step, what is the worst case time of that step? Okay? And if you're doing something within a nested loop, you multiply them. If you're doing things one thing, and then when that's finished, the next thing, the big onus is the biggest of those two, right? Suppose this took n squared time, and this took n. It would be an n squared operation plus an n operation. What's that in the big O? N squared. Okay? Any questions about that? So it's important to be able to think about these algorithms and do that kind of gross analysis. Most of the analysis we will do of programs is fairly gross once you have written down the program. Not all, but the vast majority of it. Any questions? Okay, good. So let's summarize this. Bink. Again, why was this thing n squared? It was because the innermost loop goes around n times at worst. It's surrounded by an outermost loop that n times n is n squared. Bingo. That was how I would do the analysis. Someone who wants to be more precise about it might actually count all the steps more rigorously. We noticed that the outer loop went around from 0 to n minus 1. That was where we got our outer loop going around n times. The inner loop, remember, did not go around n times, but went around at first n times, then n minus 1, then n minus 2. Does everybody agree with that? It could be that instead of just saying the big O upper bound, maybe we want to count really how fast is it in the worst case. That would be a theta of bound. To argue about that more carefully, we would have to count this thing out and build a summation. The inner loop goes from I minus 1 to N. And for each execution of the inner loop, it takes constant time, one step. What is the value of this inner loop if we sum it up? Okay? If it goes from n minus 1 to I minus 1, how many values in there is it doing? If you go from 1 to 2, how many values are you looking at? 2. Does everybody agree with that? 1 and 2. It's the big thing, 2 minus 1 gives you 1, right? So you have to add one more to it. Does everybody agree with that? So n minus 1 minus I minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 gives us this. Summing this thing up precisely, you know, again, you know, you did summations when you were in, you know, at various levels of discrete math. You could sum this thing up and eventually get an exact sum that is going to grow something like n squared over 2. Does everybody agree with that? To get an exact running analysis, you should in principle do these kind of steps. But doing an exact running analysis is complicated and tedious, and I don't like to do it. Get it wrong if I try to be too precise. In fact, I got it wrong in the book on this particular slide. Okay? The way I avoid that is I do my analysis by thinking about the worst case at each step and multiplying them if they're nested or adding them if they're not nested. And that gets you where you're going almost all the time. Any questions about big O analysis? Where these things come from? Anything like that? Okay, how are we doing on time? Pretty good. Okay? Any other questions about where these things come from? Or issues that might arise if you were asked to analyze an algorithm. Okay? Questions? Okay, good. No. Oh, no. Okay. The other thing I really want to talk about to finish, let's say, the section on mathematical preliminaries is what a logarithm is, okay? You guys all have seen logarithms. All of you, people still own pocket calculators these days, right? As technology moves on, people own more and more advanced things, okay? But everybody still owns a pocket calculator. Is that true? Anybody not own a pocket calculator? You don't, okay? Maybe technology has moved on. Do your pocket calculators have a log function on that? Okay? How many people ever hit the log function? Okay, a few of you. Okay, many of you just don't like it, okay? You don't remember, you know that they were logarithms. You, at various points in your classes, talked about logarithms, okay? But you probably don't feel in your bones where logarithms come from, okay? And from an algorithm designer, there's two different aspects of logarithms we're going to be looking at here. One is a question of algebraically, how do you work when you see a logarithm function coming up? But the more important thing is to understand where is it that logs arise. Why is it that logarithms are essential to algorithms? Why do logarithmic things happen? Okay? And if you understand why logarithmic things happen, then you will do fine in here. But if you insist on getting obsessed with just trying to do algebraic manipulation, you won't have a chance. So what a logarithm is what we would call an inverse exponential function, okay? So let's take a look at something. An exponential function is a function like b to the x. Do we agree that if we have a function like y equals b to the x, y is going to be growing exponentially in b? If you add one more to x, you are multiplying this by b. Do we agree with that? Can anyone think of anything in your life that grows exponentially? Okay, yes. Rabbits? Okay, rabbits in principle, or, you know, various vermin, okay, tend to grow exponentially. If one mouse has two babies, okay, we have a mouse. The mouse has two babies. Each of these mice have more babies, two babies. That the number of babies that we get doubles every single time. If assuming each mice, they have, you know, practiced discipline, okay, that each one has two babies, okay, Planned Parenthood for mice, okay? The number of, you might say, well, it's good, mice are going to stay the same, that's fine, okay? But if the truth is that any mouse, after eight breeding cycles, how many mice will there be that are its descendants? Well, this one, after one cycle there is two. After two cycles there are four. After three cycles there are eight. Does everybody agree that the number of descendants as a function of the number of cycles is going to be due to the number of cycles, right? Does everybody agree with that? So the number of mice, of descendants in a birthing process like this grows exponentially, unless you succeed in killing some of the mice before they breed, right? That's the game, right? Any questions? What else in your life grows exponentially? Okay? Do any of you have credit cards? Okay, some of you have credit cards. Do any of you not pay your balance off in full each month? Okay, no one will admit to it, but I know statistically some of you don't. What happens when you do, when you don't pay off your credit card balance in full? Compounded interest, right? The loan sharks that you have with this credit card, they are basically saying, fine, this month you owe $100. Next month you owe twice that, $200. Next month, if you're paying 100% interest per month, which is higher than you're paying, okay? Next month you owe $400, $800. Does everybody see what the problem is? Your balance is growing exponentially. What is the way to think about it? That means a small amount of time, you owe a lot of money. Does everybody agree that's what exponential means? Okay? It is a process that grows rapidly. Now, what is a logarithm? When you say that y grows as b to the x, if we take the logarithm of both sides, what do we get? The logarithm of y If we take the log base b, we get log b to the y. What is the log of b to the x? Does anyone remember? How do you take the log of b to the x? You would drop the x down and take the log of the base, right? Does everybody remember that kind of rule? Don't worry about that. Don't worry about it. Take this as a definition.
Okay. Let's try one last time with this. We'll work better on the microphone next time.
What does it mean when we say x is the log base b of y? This is another way of saying that b to the x is equal to y. Okay? You know the idea that the number of children, y, is equal to 2 to the x. That made sense to you in the context of rabbits. Another way to say the exact same thing is that x is equal to the log base 2 of y. Okay? This is just another way of saying the same thing. Okay? Any questions? So if you don't understand what logs are, just remember the definition. B to the x equals y is the same as saying x equals the log of b of x. The log is basically the exponent, another way to think about it, the same way. The log base b of y is how much of an exponent do you need to raise b to something, to get it to be equal to y. Isn't that what it's saying? Log base b to the y is how big an exponent do you need to raise b to get y. Now, if you want to get y, and you have to raise b to some power to do it, do you have to raise it to a big power or a little power? Well, if exponents grow quickly, a surprisingly small value of the exponent, b to that power is going to make y. Okay? So the key point here is that the logarithm grows slowly. If you were to plot a function, draw a function, here is x, here is log x, what does that do? It grows very slowly. What is the credit card balance 2 to the x going to be doing? That does that. What is x? It's growing like that. Leaving log x in the dust, growing much faster than log x. Any questions here? Okay. So all that is important to know algebraically. But the key thing to know, okay, as a definition as to why logarithms occur in algorithms, is that logarithms measure how many times you can double something until you get to n. Or equivalently, take something of n and halve it till it gets to 1. That is what it is doing, right? What is happening? You start with one node, and you keep doubling and doubling and doubling until you get n nodes at the bottom. How many times do you have to double 1 till you get n nodes? How many? Log of n. This is the thing you got to feel in your bones. By definition, the log of n has to do with how many doublings or halvings to get from n to 1 or vice versa. Okay? Any questions? Yes? This doubling definition is respect to base 2. Now, as we will see, as an algorithms person, I don't really care much about bases other than 2 because they're all the same to me, not because I'm only focused, you know, magnetically on bases of size 2. But we'll see big O-wise, it doesn't matter if it's a base 2 or 3 or anything like that. That's why I'm not going to care about whether it's true. Okay? So basically, it might as well be thinking in terms of doubling. Okay, or having operations. Okay, any other questions about the logs? Okay, so another question at some point. Okay? So the reason why logs come up is how many times things double things till you get the N, or have things till you get the 1. Okay? And I can be sure that there's people in this room who, when I flash up an algorithm that takes N log N, they're going to be saying, where does the log come from? The answer is the log comes from how many times do you double something till it gets to N, or how many times do you have it till it gets to 1? That's the same thing, right? One is doubling is climbing up the staircase. Having is walking down the staircase. Everybody see that? That is where the logs come in. Any questions? Let's see some examples. So in binary search, how many people here have seen binary search before? Everybody raise their hand. How many people have never heard of binary search? No one will admit it, right? What is the worst case time for binary search? People say log n. But why is it log n? But what is the binary search algorithm? In binary search, you have a sorted set of things. The Manhattan phone book, right? You want to find Ischina in the Manhattan phone book. How do you do it? You open to the middle of the Manhattan phone book, and there is Monroe, Maryland. Okay? What do? You say Ischina after Monroe, Maryland. Right? Is he? Yes. So you now, what are you going to do? I'm going to focus your attention on this part of the book. Does everybody see that? How much of the book have I thrown out with one question? A half. Now I look at the next person. I look in the middle. The next person's Presley, Elvis. Okay? Ischina before or after Presley? After, right? Ischina has to be in this part of the book, which is another half of the half, right? When is our search complete? We keep having the book each time until what happens? Well, basically, till you get down to one name in the book, right? If the book had one person in it, it would be easy to tell if it's Ischina, right? Is that person Ischina? Okay? So the question really is, I start out with N elements. I want to know how many halvings does it take till I get down to 1? How many halvings does it take to get from N down to 1? How many halvings? Log N. Does everybody see that? That is by definition. It is the log base 2 of N, to be precise. Okay? But let's not worry about such details. It is log N. That is what log N means. It's how many times do I have something till I get down to 1. Any questions? Any questions about how binary search arises? Okay. Actually, the other thing to note is that binary search is really an amazingly fast algorithm if you stop and think about it. It is kind of amazing that you can search through the Manhattan phone book in 20 comparisons and find out if Ischina was there. Okay. This is really, you know, sorted out telephone books is really an enabling technology. Suppose, let's say, you wanted to find somebody's phone number. You see someone's phone number written on a bathroom wall, right? You want to figure out who is this person. How do you figure out who the person is, whose phone number is on the bathroom wall? Okay, you could call them up and ask, I guess. Okay, but if you just want to use the phone book, how do you do it? You look at every single name, right? Everybody agree with that? So doing a linear search through the Manhattan phone book, forget it. That'd be your life's project, right? To find out who the person is on the bathroom wall, okay? The fact that the thing is sorted and you can do binary search means that what would have taken you a lifetime suddenly takes you a minute, okay? This is the kind of big O improvement that we care about, right? So we greatly respect, okay, binary search because it runs in log n time. Any questions? And why does the log n come up? Why does binary search take log n time? How many times do you have the thing till it gets down to 1? Any questions? Okay. Bink. Okay? We talked about this example before about trees. But suppose I have a binary tree. Okay? How many levels do I need? Okay? I want to end up with N descendants. Okay? I have two daughters. They're going to have two children. Each of them is going to have two children. How many generations will it be till I have a million descendants? Okay? Well, what is the answer? I have two children. I have doubled my descendants, right? Each of them is going to double themselves, right? It's how many times do I double from one till I get to N? How many doublings does it take from to start from one and get to N? How many of them? Log N. Does everybody see that? What if, let's say, instead I had three children, okay? Well, let's say we had a family of three children and everybody had three children. How many doublings does it, how many generations does it take till I get down to N descendants? Well, after one generation I have three. After another I have three squared. Does everybody agree with that? Three cubed. I want to know, what is the power of H such that 3 to the H is equal to N? Does everybody agree with that? That's how I would figure that out. What is H? Take the log of both sides. What is that? If I take the log base 3 of N, it's H times the log base 3 of 3 is equal to the log base 3 of N. Does everybody agree with that? What is the log base 3 of 3? What power do I have to raise 3 to get 3? 1. That says the height is the log base 3 of N. Does everybody agree with that? Any questions? What if, on the other hand, I only had one child, and all the skeeners to come only had one child? How many generations will it take? Well, if we count all the skeeners, if we stay alive, we will have a million generations till we get a million skeeners. Does everybody see that? One of them is linear growth. One of them is exponential growth. Which is faster? The exponential growth. Does everybody see that? Do you see where the log comes in? Okay, and what the impact of the base on the log is? A question like, I don't understand why it's log base 3 would be a good question. Any questions? Okay. Any questions? Okay. Let's look at some more examples. Kabunk. Suppose, let's say, I was designing a computer, right? I want to figure out how many bits my computer word should be, right? I want to represent numbers from 0 to N, right? I want to represent the number as big as N. How many bits should my computer be? Let's say I want to build a computer for counting the number of people in the world. That's what I really think is an important thing. I want to optimize this for computing the number of people in the world. How many people are there in the world? Does anyone know? 6 billion-ish. Okay, fine. So let's say I want 10 billion people. I want to count the number up to 10 billion. Okay? How big a word length do I need to count up to 10 billion? Okay? Say 34 bits. How would I figure this thing out? If I have a 2-bit computer, what numbers can I count on a 2-bit computer? You agree I could go 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1? I could count 4 things on a 1-bit, on a 2-bit computer. Does everybody agree with that? What if I have a 3-bit computer? What number can I count on a 3-bit computer? What? 8. Does everybody agree? 0, 0. I can tack a 0 before all of these guys. Or I could tack a 1 before all of these guys. Right? So how big does my number range grow as I add another bit? it doubles, right? So how many bits do I need to count up to n? 2 to the n to count up to n? If I needed 2 to the n, I would need a bit size of 2 to the 10 billion. Wouldn't be pretty, would it? Right? How big how many bits do I need to count up to 10 billion? It is the log base 2 of 10 billion. Does everybody see that? It's how many times do I have to double from 1 until I get to a number bigger than 10 billion, right? Any questions about that? How many people see that? How many people don't see it? Okay. How many people feel that in their bones? That when you have something that when you double it a lot of times, that is what a logarithm, how many doublings it takes to get to a point is what is meant by logarithm. Any question here? Okay. Can anybody think of anything else that grows exponentially that you might encounter? Garbage? Well, it's not that a garbage grows exponentially. I don't know by what process that would be. Okay, so, maybe. Let's say maybe. I don't want to debate that right now. Okay, any questions here? Yes. Okay, so that's kind of a thing. So suppose, let's say, that what you're saying that probably is true. If I remember things about half-lives of things, right? You, let's say, steal a nuclear weapon, okay? This nuclear weapon has a certain amount of uranium in it, right? Or whatever it is that is nuclear, right? This thing has a half-life, right? That is telling me, let's say the half-life of it is 5 years. What does that mean? That after 5 years, the amount of radioactive material is cut in half, right? So one thing you might be saying is, ha-ha, I've got this nuclear weapon. I'll save it, pass it on to my children, so they will be able to sell it to some terrorist group or something like that, right? But it'll be worth a lot more. The terrorists will have more money then or something like that. Why is that a bad strategy? Because after 5 years, you will have half as much plutonium, right? And 5 years more, you've got a quarter as much plutonium, right? You want to know if you have a certain number of billions of atoms, 10 to the Avogadro numbers, number of atoms. That was like, what was it? Avogadro's number was 10 to the 23rd. How many halvings does it take till you have one lousy atom of uranium left, of fissionable material? It would basically be the log of this, okay, times 5 years, right? Whatever the half-life is. And what you will find is that you will take you a the log of 10 to the 20. What is the log of 10 to the 23rd? Okay, how many times half do we have to have 10 to the 23rd till we get down to 1? Just to get a sense for this. How many times do we have to have 10 till we get down to 1? Like 3.5. So to get rid of the first 10 takes 3.5 cycles, right? To get rid of the second 10 takes another 3.5 cycles, right? In only 3.5 times 24 generations, you will be down to one lousy atom of uranium, right? And then poof, it's gone and you don't have anything to worry about. Any questions about that? So it's really a small number of years relative to the large number of atoms. That's an interesting example here. Any questions here? Okay. So why are you worried about radioactive particles? Well, this is how many generations times the half-life, right? Now, if the half-life is 5 years, 100 generations times 5 years is still 500 years, right? That's something to worry about, right, on human scale. If the half-life is more than 5 years, okay, like some of these things that have half-lives of thousands of years, then you've got trouble, right? Any questions? But you see what it is? I mean, if the half-life is very quick, the stuff disappears quickly. I shouldn't be lecturing on chemistry here. But you know that when you look at a periodic table, right? They're the atoms, the elements that really exist. right? Those are the ones that go up to about 92. And then there's those strips on the bottom of these synthetic man-made elements, right? That somebody made in a reactor. These tend to be very unstable. The half-life is in a fraction of a second. So what happens? The physicists bang these molecules together. They make this stuff. They say, look, we made 100 atoms of it. The half-life is a second. Poof. 5 seconds later, the stuff doesn't exist anymore. If the half-life was fast, on any scale, it's not very around very long, right? If it decays exponentially, it will go away fast on geological scales. The trouble is if the half-life itself is long, then a small number of generations times a long life is still a long life. Any questions? Okay? Very good. Let me show you one last example of a exponential time thing. Hold on a second. Actually, maybe two things. One is it one algebraic relation you should know? Okay? Is it the log base A of X times Y? Is the log of A base A of X times plus the log base B of Y? Okay? How many people remember this expression from high school? Said that the log of a product is the sum of the logs. Does everybody agree with that? Why is that useful? Well, that was useful back in the Stone Age when I was growing up, when people had slide rules, okay? I actually was just at the end of the slide rule generation. I'm not as old as you might think, okay? But nonetheless, slide rules worked on logarithms. They were good at letting people multiply numbers. Why? Because to multiply two numbers reduced to adding up two logarithms, okay? That's why this expression was useful for slide rules. Any questions? One other thing. Suppose, let's say, it was the log of A times Y. What is the log base A of A times Y? That would be the log base A of A times the log base A of Y. What is the log base A of Y? What's the log base A of A? Does everybody see that? A times Y, the log of that is 1 plus the log of Y, right? It's because we divided it by A, and we add 1 to the logarithm, right? Logarithm is counting how many times do we divide the thing down by A till we get where we're going. Any questions? Okay. Sorry, I want to try one last example. I know I'm running a little late, but it's a cute example and it's quick. Okay? Actually, maybe not. Maybe I'll go through this next class. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so we'll talk a little bit more about logarithms. And make sure you pick up the first homework. And any questions? Thanks for your attention. See you on Thursday.